Hello, and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising facts and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that avocado you're eating is radioactive. Actually, so is that banana sitting at your desk, as is almost every ordinary object in your home. According to a study out of North Carolina State University, we actually interact with radioactive materials every day. Now, you might assume that all radioactive materials are dangerous, if not deadly, but researchers of the study wanted to prove that that wasn't the case, and that a little bit of radiation is not only quite common, but probably won't hurt. Researchers used a portable gamma radiation meter to measure the external gamma radiation emitted in a North Carolina home. The radiation was measured in a unit called microgray per hour. So they found that bricks, for example, gave off 0.15 microgray, whereas avocados and smoke detectors gave off 0.16, and bananas topped them all at 0.17. By comparison, natural uranium gives off 9 times that amount. Now, what does all this mean? Yes, you can consume all that delicious fruit and have a working smoke detector in your home. Radiation is a natural part of life. That's the point of the study, to take away the panic. In fact, on average, people will naturally absorb the equivalent of 6,000 microgray units in a year. A transatlantic flight alone will set you back 50 micrograys. A whole body CT scan will actually tip you over at 10,000 micrograys. If you're getting a lot of CT scans or flying across the world a ton or just eating loads of bananas, don't worry. Your body can actually handle a lot more radiation. In fact, there are people who have to work around radiation, so for them, there's a regulatory limit in effect. That amount is 50,000 micrograys per year. So to hit that 50,000 limit, you'd have to eat nearly 300,000 bananas, which is probably unhealthy for more reasons than radioactivity. This week I learned that if you have a middle initial, you'd be well advised to start using it. According to a new paper published in the European Journal of Social Psychology, you're perceived as being smarter if you display your middle initial. The researchers conducted 7 experiments to see how middle initials in names affect the perception of a person by others. In one study, for example, participants read a piece of writing by an author whose name was displayed with varying numbers of middle initials from 0 to 4. And the participants rated the writing more positively when the author's name included at least one of those middle initials. In another study, participants were more likely to link middle initial names to organizations that had to do with intelligence. Now, as the good people at PopSci point out, the authors of the study both list their names with middle initials, so there might be a little bit of bias there. But on the whole, now is as good a time as any to embrace that exceptionally embarrassing middle name. This week I learned the surprisingly dark existential origins of the Nobel Prizes. They are considered the highest honor in the fields of physics, chemistry, medicine, literature, and peace. Albert Einstein, Marie Curie, Martin Luther King Jr., the Red Cross, and as of this year, Bob Dylan have all been named laureates in various fields. But the prizes actually have a really dark backstory, which I came across while searching Maria Popova's treasure trove of aside brain pickings. Here's the gist on the Nobel. In 1888, a humble Swede by the name of Ludwig Nobel died. But his obituary, as written up by the French press, confused Ludwig with his younger brother Alfred, who was still very much alive. Alfred was much more famous than his brother, having amassed a fortune by inventing such deadly weaponry as dynamite and projectiles. In the obit, Alfred was called the tradesman of death. It's a very peculiar thing to be able to watch your legacy unfold while you're still alive, and Alfred's response was one of heartbreak and existential guilt. Determined to change his story before it was too late, Alfred wrote up his final will and testament, establishing a fund from his estate awarded to the person from any country who had made the most important discovery each year in 4 fields, as well as one awarded for the promotion of peace. After Alfred died a year later, his wishes were met with a lot of resistance. His relatives were completely unaware and shocked, and the Swedish royal family found the whole nationality blind element unpatriotic. But the time was against them. With the first Olympic Games happening in Greece, the seedlings for bolstering an international community were established, and the very first prizes were awarded soon after in 1901. This week I learned that in the early 20th century, when women were fighting for the right to vote, some suffragettes had to literally fight back, and they did so with martial arts. This story comes from the BBC magazine, and it takes place in London before the war. The struggle for the right to vote grew increasingly violent and bitter around this time. Suffragettes staged hunger strikes, they marched, they protested, and were arrested or worse for their efforts. There was one particularly brutal demonstration in 1910 in London that may have turned the tides. Some 300 suffragettes were outnumbered by police and male vigilantes who blocked the road. The women were attacked, beaten down, and even groped. 100 women were arrested and many were severely injured. In fact, two would actually die as a result. After that incident, women did not want to come unprepared for anything. Some would cover their ribs with cardboard when they went out. Others would hide clubs under their coats. Others still sought out the martial arts expertise of one suffragette by the name of Edith Garud. Garud was trained in the ancient Japanese art of jujitsu, which was based more on skill than brawn and uses the opponent's force against them. Garud held demonstrations at suffragette meetings, and by the time of the 1910 assault, Garud was actually running suffragette-only jujitsu classes. Confrontations between suffragettes and police only got worse as the years went on. More and more women were arrested, and while in jail, many would stage hunger strikes. To gain power back over the suffragettes, England instituted a sketchy law in 1913 that was known as the Cat and Mouse Act. Officials would release hunger strike activists back onto the streets. They'd let them regain their health and then swoop in when they weren't doing anything wrong and arrest them on the original charges. With high-ranking suffragettes being targeted by this act, the jiu-jitsu fighting activists rallied. With Edith Garud as their leader, about 30 of the martial art-trained women formed a group called the Bodyguard. They were covertly sent all over the United Kingdom to protect the leaders of the movement. They not only used jiu-jitsu, but also diversion tactics. There was one incident in Camden Yards. A leading suffragette was giving a speech, and the police planned to arrest her afterward. The bodyguard dressed another woman up like her and then escorted the decoy out of the building. The police descended and actually knocked the decoy down and dragged her away. When they triumphantly unveiled the unconscious woman, they realized they'd been had. Their original target, meanwhile, snuck out the other side of the building during the ruckus. Eventually, with the outbreak of World War I, Edith Garud and the bodyguard shifted their focus to the war efforts, as many suffragettes did. Finally, in England, at the end of the war in 1918, the Representation of the People Act was passed, allowing women over the age of 30 to vote. It would take another decade before all women in England would get the same voting rights as men. And that does it for this week's episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. To read more about any of the facts I've mentioned or to check out more podcasts from the week, including 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainers, go to theweek.com/podcasts. And if you like what you hear, subscribe, tell your friends, or give us a rating or a review on iTunes. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.